Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 6, delivered on February 2nd, 2012. The title of this lecture is The Three Tools of Monetary Policy.
Today, the three tools of monetary policy. I want to make sure you understand why I am talking about the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is intimately involved in the construction of interest rates. Specifically, the Federal Reserve controls short-term interest rates. And as a result of that, it has effect on long-term interest rates. Unfortunately, that effect on long-term interest rates fades over time. In fact, even its control over short-term interest rates fades over time if the Fed overuses its hand. And so when I talk about the Fed, I'm talking about an important short to intermediate term player in the interest rate environment. For businesses, that means everything, because interest rates drive the cost of capital. The cost of capital drives what we're going to invest in. If I've got a project that's going to return me 10% and the marginal cost of capital is 12%, well, I'm not going to take the project. So we care deeply about what the Fed is up to. We watch the Fed's moves and listen to the Fed's stories quite a bit in the business world, because it tells us, okay, what's going on right now. The Fed has said that it is going to maintain easy money for another 2 years at least. In other words, it's going to try to keep interest rates low. Low interest rates will, of course, stimulate investment. Investment will stimulate job formation. Job formation will stimulate business activity. Business activity will stimulate more investment. So when the Fed says, Uncle Ben Bernanke says, we're going to keep interest rates low for another 2 years, well, businesses get all kinds of happy about that. And only people like me, who have such a sour outlook on life, say, bad move, asshole, because that's going to create inflation, and sooner or later, that great business environment is going to evaporate into strong inflation. But I am a marginal voice. For the typical business out there, this is essentially the starting pistol. Let's get this economy rolling again. For you, that means that you'll go out and get a job in a good hiring environment. You'll make a lot of money. Maybe $80,000, okay, $20,000 a year, something like that. No, it's actually, for you, it's meaningful, because quite honestly, 2 years ago, it sucked trying to find jobs for all the grads. Only the cream of the crop, the ones with the 4.0, and they belonged to five different organizations, and they'd already cured cancer and made world peace. Those were the ones who were getting jobs. Now, normal students can get jobs out there, too, and it's much more robust. Just honestly, I've got calls, oh, we're going to pick up some interns. What do you got? I didn't hear anything of that 2 years ago. So that the business environment is recovering, and the Fed logically is trying to keep that ball rolling by not scaring the markets with the possibility of high interest rates soon. We want the businesses to start planning not for tomorrow, but for a year from now, 2 years from now. In other words, big projects, big amounts of money invested, and big jobs coming on the scene. Before I go any further, just news that's important to you. What company is doing an insanely large IPO very soon? Yeah? Facebook. And the question that a the typical investor, oh, I want to buy some Facebook stock. For you as informed leaders of the future, God help us, for you, the question is, why that amount of money? Yeah, what would you say?
They could start investing in their own internet currency.
Possibly. That's one of the big talk right now, is that they are going to become a player in the world of the future currencies. And I'm going to have you read a second article getting you further involved in understanding how those currencies are going to dominate the 21st century. What else could they be doing? Anything else that you could think of that Zuckerberg could do with all of that money besides buy half of the universe? Anything else that they do? Well, you got to think about it, because if they actually have a successful IPO, which they will become a dominant force on the business landscape of the coming couple of decades. In fact, they will become almost a quasi-sovereign force. If they start working towards their own currency, then that means that they take on almost some of the aspects of a nation, and that's important. Especially since almost all of you are on Facebook, they will have be a major force in your social lives and possibly in your business lives. Let me get down to business here. I talked to you last time about one of the three tools of monetary policy. That tool of monetary policy, and I will write these down so that you can get these. Projector on, and turn this on, and let's try to see if I can actually get this to focus here. Make sure that you can see all of this. Document camera. Okay, monetary policy. The three tools. And some of this discussion goes beyond just the Fed, especially the second one. Three tools the Fed has at its disposal. The meat cleaver, the one that would be used the least frequently because of its power as a money multiplier, is the required reserve ratio. That was the one I talked about last time. Again, as you saw, it's the money multiplier is 1 over the required reserve ratio in its simplest form. That is a hellacious thing to talk about, is something that could, you change that RRR and you actually change the speed, or the amount, I should say, the amount of money that evolves as a multiplier of that. So that one's a big meat cleaver. Fed doesn't use it very often at all. And truth be told, I don't know that they would use it, at least change it, for the purpose of changing the growth of the money supply. That would just be, it would be almost unpredictable how forceful it would be. To give you an idea of this, we can talk about the formula, 1 over RRR is the money multiplier, and then a more realistic one that includes the possibility that people are holding cash balances would be 1 plus their cash balances. Let me write that as a C. 1 plus the amount of money that they have that they keep in their pockets as a percentage over RRR plus C. That's the more realistic version of the money multiplier that includes the possibility people don't put all of their money in the bank. So that's a more realistic one, but still, nevertheless, talking about it in real terms, in real world terms, we can say, all right, let's estimate the amount of percentage of money people are keeping in their pockets, and then let's also see what the Fed's required reserve ratio is, and we can get a theoretical number. Then we can actually go out and do some empirical work and say, what is it really? What's the money multiplier look like really? Interestingly enough, in the real world, the money multiplier is somewhat related to the formula, but it isn't exactly. And sometimes it's an awful lot different from what we would predict it is from the even the more complex formula here. If I'm recalling right, the money multiplier 2 years ago, even though the Fed was keeping RRR very low, cash balances were pretty high at that time, so there's something that was slowing down the multiplier effect. But the real world one was under 3. The factor was 3. And the formula was predicting that it would be around 5 to 7. So it's a little unpredictable. Anyway, let me get this one off the board. The second tool of monetary policy is the discount rate. The Fed sets a rate at which it will lend money to banks. Banks can go up to the discount window and say, I should like to borrow some money. Now, if I were teaching this class 3-4 years ago, I mean, anytime up to three years ago, I would have said the discount rate doesn't really matter in and of itself because banks don't borrow from the Fed. Here's why. They have another place they can borrow. They can borrow from other banks in an interbank lending market called the federal funds market. It's the alternative banks can go to and borrow at the federal funds rate, which is higher than the discount rate. Think about the federal funds market as the giant ocean of all of the money banks have to lend. The Fed funds market is literally, it's in a sense kind of theoretical, but it's very real in its consequences. It's just the vast pool of money all banks have in their vaults, in electronic computers, out there somewhere. That's the money. And that money, there's a supply of it out there. There's a supply in the Fed funds market at any given time. If I were to write the Fed funds market, and I would say, okay, there's a quantity of lendable funds, Q, lendable funds. And there is a price for those lendable funds, which is the Fed funds rate. This is the rate at which banks would lend to each other. So there will be a supply of lendable funds out there, and there will be a demand for lendable funds out there. And then on any given day, based upon the supply and demand, there will be a federal funds rate. It is a market rate. It is driven by supply and demand conditions. The Federal Reserve can't set this rate. It can target it, and it can do something to move it, but it can't set it. So a bank can go to the Federal Reserve discount window and borrow money from the Fed at the discount rate, or it can go to other banks in the interbank lending market and borrow funds at the federal funds rate, which is higher. Well, up until a few years ago, banks usually just went to the federal funds market. They didn't go to the discount window. Why didn't they go to the discount window if the Fed would lend them money at a lower rate than they could get from other banks in the interbank lending market? It worked like this. Sir, you've had an accident with a car. Now, you can go to your father and say, I need to borrow $1,000. You know he's going to lend it to you at no interest or maybe a low interest. Or you can borrow it from me. I'll charge you a higher interest rate. Okay, now, if you go to the Fed, if you go to your father, he's going to ask you what the hell happened. He's going to maybe lecture you. Hell, he might even call you a hurtful name. Or he might say you're ugly and that's because your mother is. Okay? He might even say, you know what, you were adopted. Okay, something like that. I, on the other hand, oh, you asshole, okay, fine. Give me the money. Lend you the money. Not give it to you. I'll lend it to you. Higher rate. But you see, the difference was that banks, really, it was, if for all intents and purposes, it was better to just work it out with the other banks, get your money borrowed from them, than to go to the discount window where Uncle Sugar had the money at low rates, but then you had to deal with Uncle Sugar and his bitchiness. So that was why, really, until a couple of years ago, I would have said the discount rate, which the Fed posts and it changes it or keeps it the same at each of its meetings 8 times a year, sometimes it'll even change it between meetings, that rate the Fed can set because it's the lender at the discount window. But the federal funds rate, it cannot set. It can say this is what we want it to be, but it can't force it to be that. So until a couple of years ago, I would have said the discount rate is not a functional rate, it's a signal. Signaling is very important, and it picked up, actually, interestingly enough, it was being better understood. That finally, a good comprehensive understanding of signaling theory was showing up when I was a grad student. You see, the discount rate, if no one's borrowing at the discount rate, who cares about it? Well, we do care about it because the Fed is signaling what it wants by the discount rate. If the Fed raises the discount rate by 0.25%, the Fed is signaling that it wants to slow down the economy. If the Fed lowers the discount rate by 0.25%, that's the Fed signaling that it wants to boost the economy. If the Fed says we have left the discount rate unchanged at this meeting, that tells us that the Fed is signaling that it is okay with where the economy is going at the present time. So as a signal, the discount rate is vastly important. The same is true, signaling theory isn't just about the Fed. When you think about a corporation, dividends are one of the most illogical things you could ever see a corporation do, just on a financial level. Why would a company give a dividend to its shareholders instead of using that money to reinvest in the operations to make the company grow? Why would it do that? Here's my damn money. Here, we made $1 million. We're going to give you $200,000 of it. You're just the owner. You can't sue me if I don't give it to you. I could take that $200,000 and invest it back in the company. That's $200,000 I don't have to borrow, and I could use for capital investments to make the company grow and the stock do better, and that would benefit you in the long run. Why in the hell do companies give dividends? Finally, it was understood. Oh, it's a signal. It's a signal that the company is able to do that, that it can do that, that it is so financially worthy that it can light a cigar with a $100 bill, if you will. That's signaling. And in business, we see signaling a lot, not just in dividends, but we see it in other ways too. What would seem on the surface to be kind of like, why would they do that? Underneath it, we know, oh, it's a signal that they are sending to the markets, and the markets have to figure out what the signal means. And we're pretty good at doing that. Sometimes we say WTF, but for the most part, signals are highly, highly useful, institutionalized, structured, and quite prevalent out there. So the Fed, historically, the discount rate was just a signal. Then things changed a couple of years ago. The Fed started offering basically free interest loans, interest-free loans, zero interest loans at the discount window. Pretty much, either almost no interest on them or no interest on them. Okay, if you're a bank and you're looking at the Fed funds market, the rate here is 3.25%, and I've got to borrow $10 million. Or the Fed's discount window is 0%, I can step up to that, and they're all being a bunch of nice pansies now, patsies. Hell, I'll go to the discount window. The culture of borrowing at the bank level began to change. Here's what was weird about it, though. Fed brought down the discount rate basically to zero, and it just kept it there. And so banks, of course, lined up for this money, And there were a lot of economists who said, oh, this is fantastic. Banks are going to get all this money, and then they'll start lending like fools to everyone, and the economy will just explode. Strange things happened. The banks didn't lend the money out. That credit crunch just stayed. The bank said, well, we ain't going to lend money because businesses and people just aren't trustworthy. They might default. Can we borrow some more Fed? Oh, sure, here's some more. The Fed kept lending money at the discount window, shoveling it into the banks. And still the banks kept saying, well, there's a credit crunch. We really can't be lending money to anyone or to businesses right now. And it was quite frustrating. It was just like, are you kidding? We're lending you billions of dollars, and you're doing nothing with the money to boost the economy? What are you doing with that money? That's another story I'll tell you later. But they were that credit crunch stayed, and that was one of the reasons the economy kept sputtering for a couple of years, was because the Fed's big effort to infuse liquidity straight to the banks through the discount window with these pretty much free loans, that money wasn't fanning out into the economy through lending to businesses, lending to people. But anyway, there you are. The deal here is, as I said, that the discount rate and the federal is set by the Fed. The Fed's the lender and can set whatever rate it wants. The federal funds rate is set by supply and demand conditions in an open, more or less free market. So that rate obviously can't be set by the Fed. What's funny is, so often you'll see after a Fed meeting, these financial experts, these financial news channels, financial news articles will say, the Federal Reserve set the federal funds rate at, I've seen it so many times, and you just say, oh God, they don't set it. They'll announce they have a target in mind for it, but they can't set it. They set the discount rate, and then they say, well, this is what we want the Fed funds rate to be. But the Fed does get involved, as I said. They have a target, and they don't just say, this is what we'd like the Fed funds rate to be. They have a mechanism for moving the Fed funds rate to their target. That is the third leg of monetary policy tools. It is by far the most common, used every day to the tune of billions and billions of dollars. It also impacts, in many ways, the politics in Washington. It has had major influence. It did in the late 20th century and the first years of the 21st century. And I'll explain that in a minute, but let me explain what open market operations are. The Federal Reserve, let me write this down. Open market operations. OMOs. And by this open right here, that means that the Fed is stepping into the pure raw world of trading in a security. Very specifically in two securities. I should be very specific, two securities. Out there in the open market, with the global traders, with all of the suppliers of these two securities, well, actually, there's only one supplier, one of those securities, and all the demanders of those securities. But their target market is a specific type of demander of those securities. The demander is the banks in the Fed system. Let me explain how it works. The Federal Reserve is the seven governors and then those 12 bank presidents. There is a committee that is it's a subcommittee of the Federal Reserve. It's called the Federal Open Market Committee. It comprises all seven governors on the Federal Reserve Board, and five district bank presidents. Now, the seven governors are always there. These five governors, four of them serve 2-year terms, and then they give it over to another. Then it moves on to another governor. So you might be the governor of the Atlanta Bank. You'd serve for 2 years, and then you'd be gone, and maybe the governor of the St. Louis Bank would take your place. One of the governors has a permanent, one of the bank presidents has a permanent seat, permanent voting seat. That is the president of the Empire Bank, the bank in New York City, for the New York District. He has a permanent seat, and you'll see why in a minute here. So, the total number of voting members on the FOMC is 12 voting members. The 7 governors and 5 district bank presidents. 4 are on rotating 2-year terms. 1 is permanent of the district presidents. Now, these 12 people, the Federal Open Market Committee, meets 8 times a year. They can also meet in emergency or special sessions at their discretion at other times. At each one of these sessions, they make a decision, a couple of decisions. Are they going to ease up and make more money available? Are they going to stay put and keep the liquidity level about the same in the economy? Or are they going to contract and pull back, claw back the money in the economy? That's essentially the broad outline of what they decide. They get the advice of the best economists they can find who work for the Fed. Outsiders also can provide them with advice. They get advice and on the side from politicians sometimes, although that's not supposed to be how it works. They are sensitive to the political environment, but mainly what they're looking at is, okay, how much help does the economy need right now in terms of liquidity? And what is the risk of inflation firing up if we do help? That's the outline of what drives their decision making at any given Fed meeting. Now, operationally, they will signal the market through the discount rate and the Fed funds target. Okay, the discount rate is 0.50%. We are going to change it to 0.25% and then announce it, that we've done that at this FOMC meeting. That would be a signal that they want to see monetary policy eased up more. They want more liquidity available, more credit available. By dropping the discount rate, they are signaling everyone out there, we want the economy to boost up more because it's a little sluggish. If they were to say, we are going to raise the discount rate from 0.50 to 7.75%, usually it's in quarter percent increments, 250 basis points. It can be more than that. That would be a signal that the majority of the Fed members see a risk of inflation as being higher than a risk of recession. That right now, the balance of the Fed governors are on the side of easy money. The risk of inflation does not merit clawing back the liquidity right now. There are, however, inflation hawks, especially among, interestingly enough, district bank presidents. You'll see some real hardcore inflation hawks. They'll say, are you nuts? We've got inflation waiting right around the corner. We need to stop pouring money into the market. At the present time, they are outgunned by the governors who are mostly saying the economy still needs help, than by a few district bank presidents who say, yeah, in my district, things are still kind of shaky, so I'd like to see easy money for a little while longer. See, those district bank presidents, they're thinking about the nation, but they're also thinking about their region as well. So right now, in what's really going on right now, the balance is toward easy money, with the governors pretty much all saying, keep money easy, and a few of the bank presidents that are voting saying, keep money easy. Again, though, you'll see some inflation hawks. Normally, these guys are real pros. Men and women are really pros. They don't let air out their dirty laundry. They might not like a decision, but they won't talk too much about it. Recently, in the last few years, you've seen some of these inflation hawks get a little noisier, interviewing with newspapers, with financial journals, and things like that, letting it be known that they think that the Fed's easy money is not a good idea. They're talking a little more. Normally, you wouldn't see that kind of stuff. So if we're seeing it, we're seeing what I would interpret as deep rifts between those who are more politically sensitive, we got to keep the economy going, and those who are more looking at what's going to happen if we don't stop pouring money into the economy. Okay. I'm going to show you how the open market operations work. And this is a little bit simplified. I get people listening to this podcast and they'll point out, well, that's not really, there's this step right in here. Oh, stop it. It's pretty much how it works. What I'm going to tell you. Okay. Now, over here, I'm going to draw a little box. This is a member bank in the Federal Reserve System. Now, in terms of Tier 1 capital, highly liquid assets of the bank, it will have two almost perfectly substitutable, highly liquid assets. It will have dollars, cash money, and every bit as safe are its T-bills. These are the highest liquidity capital the bank has. This was something that was a concern back in the time when the banks were getting into trouble, was this highly liquid capital was virtually non-existent in many banks. And so you would have these investment analysts, they would look at the assets of a bank. Oh, this bank's got tons of assets. Invest in it. Go ahead. It's a great deal. They were too stupid to look inside of those financial statements and look at how much of those assets were Tier 1 capital. If they looked at that, they would say, oh my God, they don't have enough money to pay the damn light bill. But they weren't doing it that way. And there were all of these investment specialists on television, radio, and the newspapers back in the 2005 and all that. All of these banks are great investments. Look at all these assets they have. It's unbelievable. But then they weren't looking at how much of that was that kind of money. Now, you understand this is a balancing act. They can't have too much money liquid because it won't work for them. But if you've got that kind of money, it's not going into those long-term investments that would yield good results. But you can't have none of it either, for God's sake. So there's a balancing. So ideally, there's going to be this nice pad of this highly liquid asset structure comprising dollars and T-bills in a bank at any given time. Now we have the FOMC. It has just had a meeting. It just finished a meeting. The vote was add liquidity. In other words, pour some more money into the market. So the way it would work is that once the decision has been made that there should be more liquidity in the economy, the Fed governor from New York takes these orders and communicates them to his bank. Why is he in charge of that? Because at the Empire Bank, the New York District Fed is what is called the domestic trading desk. It is at the Empire Bank. And when I say desk, I'm not talking about one of those you buy at Walmart and build yourself. The desk there means literally floor after floor after floor, football-sized fields of traders. The Empire Bank district president He's permanent on the board because he's the one who takes these marching orders down to his bank and says, here we go. We've decided to add liquidity. He communicates that to the desk manager. The desk manager then sends it out to the floor. And every one of the traders on the floor then has the marching orders. Here's how it works. I'm trying to think. You look like you like money. Do you? Well, kind of, maybe. Could be, Wabbit. Okay, now, if you're a trader, you have got, I'll be metaphorical about this. You are sitting on a giant pile of dollar bills. That's your chair. It's really comfortable. Now, it's not just dollar bills. You've got on one side of you, and I'll have to switch to a guy because it gets a little bit vulgar here. You're now a trader. You're sitting, I just realized I can't use a lady for this one. You're a trader. Okay, you are sitting on this pile of dollar bills. But unfortunately, only one of your ass halves is sitting on dollars. The other ass half is sitting on T-bills. You have a portfolio that is yours. Well, not yours. You can't take it home and, you know, party with it. But you have one butt loaf that has dollar bills under it, and the other butt loaf, panini bread, it's kind of soft. Concentrate. You have these T-bills. These are yours for trading purposes. It's yours. Now, you are going to have the order from the desk manager, add liquidity to the market. So, I'm a bank. I'm a member bank. And I'm sitting in my bank office, in my bank chair. I'm a happy banker. And I get a call from you. Ring, ring. Hello, I'm a bank president. Who are you? And it's you. I'm a trader. Now, your job is to get me to accept more money. Well, that sounds like that's an easy job. But you can't just say, I'm going to send you money. You got to make a deal with me. Now remember, I've got tier one capital. I've got dollar bills and I've got T-bills. That's my tier one capital. Your job is to make me change my balance so that I have more dollars and fewer T-bills. Your job, over here, you've got dollars and you've got T-bills. Your job is to induce me to give up a T-bill for a dollar bill. That's what you want to do. You see, because that will add dollars into the federal funds market, that vast ocean. Because if you get me to accept a dollar for a T-bill, I'm going to be so happy. Because I'll put that in the bank. I'll put that in the federal funds market. And that's how you, as a trader, add liquidity into the banking system. Okay, so here we go. You simply call me up on the phone. Your job is to get me to take dollars. Okay, now remember, I've got two things. I've got dollars and T-bills. So you're going to have to get me to give up a T-bill. And in exchange, you're going to give me some money for it. Okay, let's say you start out, you say to me, you know what, I'll pay you $950 for one of your T-bills. Now I'm a bank president and I'm going to say, you know, I kind of like those T-bills because they get me interest, you know, and all that kind of stuff. I'll get $1,000 from the government at the end of the year. So I'll keep my T-bills. Why don't you, you know, thank you for calling. Please go to hell. And you say, whoa, 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 slow down there, Sparky. And I said, don't call me Sparky. And you say, surely you would. And I said, don't call me Shirley either, for God's sake. Are you trying to do a deal with me? What is this? Okay. You've got to get a T-bill out of my clutches. I like these things. What are you going to do? Good. Offer more than 1,000. No, you offered me 950. Come on. Now I said no to 950. Don't be, remember what Arnold Schwarzenegger said? Don't be a girly man. Okay, you're not a girly man, okay? You gotta, bid up, offer me something better.
Is
Over 1,000. 1,000 means there's no interest. Come on, go up to 975. 975. What are you, crazy? I'm not going to take 975. I like my T-bill. Come on. You are not going to be a trader. So, 990. Oh, 990. Oh, damn. Oh. Well, 990. Okay, I'll give you a T-bill for 990. So, looky what happened there. I just sold your ass a T-bill. And in exchange, you handed me a dollar. 990 of them, specifically. You added liquidity. You did that. Now, if a whole bunch of traders are calling bank presidents all over the country, banks are getting calls from traders just like you. Just a hammering thousands and thousands of calls by the hour. You can see what's happening there is that T-bills are flowing to the traders and the traders are flowing money into the accounts of these banks in the federal funds market. Okay, now tell me what that means. Is that if all of a sudden all these traders are calling up wanting T-bills from banks, does that mean that the demand or the supply of T-bills is changing? If a bunch of traders suddenly are calling everyone and his mother, I need a T-bill, sell me a T-bill. What is that? Is that demand or supply? Come on. Demand. Demand is surging. Out of nowhere, in the open market, all of a sudden, there's this force of these massive traders with massive amounts of money pushing demand for T-bills outward. So, in doing what he's doing here, what's happening is that the demand for T-bills is surging outward relative to the supply of T-bills because these traders are going cuckoo bananas. And of course, as the demand for T-bills goes up, what happens to the price of anything when the demand for it goes up? Price goes up. Remember what I taught you about the second lecture? When the price of a T-bill goes up, what happens to its yield? Oh, well, spank me Buddha. Yes, the yields are going down. So the first thing that's going on is with this open market operation is that liquidity is being added to the banks and the price of treasury bills is pushing upward, which is reducing the yields on treasury bills, lowering the cost of borrowing to the government. But also, that in itself is taking pressure off interest rates all over the economy because if the government isn't paying as much, then businesses don't have to pay as much for borrowed capital. So the first thing that's happening is that the yields on T-bills, T-bill yield, is going down because the price is going up, because the demand is going up, because of those traders at the domestic trading desk going crazy, buying them up from the banks. I know, trust me, I'll do this again. It takes a while for this to soak in. Now let me show you something here. There's a secondary effect. The next effect is that, see that money that you just sent to me in the market? You sent me that money? That's just money, the bank, and the bank's money goes into that vast pool called the federal funds pool, the federal funds reserve. It's just all that money. All of a sudden, all these banks are getting money sent to them by the Fed in exchange for the T-bills that the banks are sending to the Fed. So here in this vast pool, the federal funds market, all of a sudden, the water level is going up with money because the Fed is electronically transferring cash money into the federal funds market, into the accounts of all these different banks. That pool is going up, and it's actually dramatic. I mean, this is a pool of hundreds of billions of dollars, and in a couple of days of high-powered pressure from those traders, buying T-bills frantically, they can actually bump that pool. You can see it going up. And I'll tell you something about that in just a second here. But let me point this out. Okay. Now let's talk about the federal funds market. That's that market that I drew a while ago. in terms of supply and demand. There is a demand for lendable funds and a supply of lendable funds. Okay, lendable funds. And the price of lendable funds, you remember what I called the price of lendable funds in the federal funds market? What is it? Yeah, the federal funds rate. Federal funds rate. Okay, now talk to me about this market. If that pool of funds is rising, if that pool is just, all of a sudden there's just money pouring into that pool, is that a supply change or a demand change? Supply. Is supply going up or supply going down? So the supply. So what's going to happen to the federal funds rate? Toward the Fed's target. See, the Fed can't set it. But through the OMOs, through those open market operations, it can actually move it toward the target. Now, if that was if that seemed complicated to you, well, you're a pretty normal person. And I will do another one on Tuesday, where I'll show you what happens with contractionary monetary policy. And once you see how this works, you'll get the hang of it. But here's the upshot of it. A couple of upshots that are going on in this that are really important. First things first is that this is going on all the time. Every day, day in, day out. And it's a kind of an amazing thing that almost no one knows that this massive movement of funds in and out of markets is happening on a daily basis. Billions and billions of dollars flowing in and out. Now, the Fed in real world, if it wants to add liquidity, it will not add liquidity every day. It'll do change-ups. You watch some of the financial news networks that are really good. Right at the end of the day, you'll see kind of a cryptic little thing. The Fed's liquidity move for the day, something like that. And you'll see an up arrow or a down arrow. That's where we're looking at what the Fed has done on a given day. You see, the Fed doesn't want to just keep adding liquidity every day because arbitragers will figure out, oh, they're doing this. And so they'll be able to get in front of what the Fed's doing. So the Fed will do change-ups. Maybe one day, even though they're adding liquidity overall, most days, they'll do a day where they drain liquidity. They'll work the system backward to burn those traders who were trying to play in front of the market, play in front of them. So the Fed will vary its routine and its pattern from day to day just to keep private traders from trying to guess in front of it. So if you're interested in this kind of thing, at the end of the day, just kind of have a look at one of those financial news networks, and they'll just have this thing that'll come up, the Fed added liquidity today, or the Fed drained liquidity today. And that gives you an idea. Look at the pattern. Don't look at the single day results. Okay, now, here are a couple of insights into this that are on the more troubling side. Understand this. First of all, the open market operations are the most common, most powerful tool the Fed has for affecting the real economy, the actual economy. Through the open market operations, it's moving interest rates around. It's moving money into the banking system and out of the banking system. It is literally the single most powerful agent in the macro economy. In the short run. In the short run, the Fed is far more powerful than the Congress in terms of macroeconomic policy. Now, think about this. Remember that Treasury bills are one of the three types of instruments that the Treasury of the United States uses to borrow money. Treasury bills, that's the way the government borrows short-term. Treasury notes, that's the way the government borrows intermediate run. And Treasury bonds, that's how the government borrows long term. And the government uses these instruments, it sells them, that's equivalent to borrowing money from investors. What would happen to the supply of treasury bills if the government stopped running budget deficits? What would happen to the number of T-bills?
Yeah?
It would actually disappear completely. There wouldn't be any T-bills, because T-bills are the Treasury borrowing short-term money. If the government no longer was in the business of borrowing money because it had enough tax revenue to pay its bills, then that would mean that there would be no T-bills, and that would mean that there could be no open market operations. And that would mean that the Federal Reserve was no longer a player in the macroeconomy, in the short-run macroeconomy. Do you see what I'm saying here? The way open market operations are conducted, they have to have dollar bills and they have to have T-bills. They have to. Those both have to exist. And remember, T-bills expire, they mature in a year, so there has to be a constant replenishment of them by the government borrowing more money, issuing more T-bills so that those are available for the Fed to use in this OMO. If the government stopped running budget deficits, there would no longer be T-bills, and open market operations would no longer be possible because there wouldn't be any T-bills for the traders. That's what happened when the government started running budget surpluses at the end of the 1990s. The government ran one budget surplus, then it ran a larger, then it ran a larger. And in 2001, it ran quite a nice one at the end of 2001. Essentially, the Federal Reserve could no longer conduct any open market operations. It was out of business. The chairman of the Federal Reserve was Alan Greenspan. He kept saying, oh, there's going to be, this is irrational exuberance, I'm raising interest rates. Six consecutive increases in the discount rate. He said, oh, the economy can't just keep going, there's going to be inflation. There wasn't. So after Clinton left office in January of 2002, the administration of George W. Bush began to send the signals out, as did the Republican Congress, that we were in danger of a severe recession. In fact, they were saying we are in a recession. Alan Greenspan got on board within a few months and said, yes, there is a recession coming. And so he supported the largest, longest tax cuts in U.S. history. Why would Alan Greenspan have supported massive, debilitating tax cuts? If the tax cuts were severe enough, the government would no longer run budget surpluses. And if it no longer ran budget surpluses, you would have T-bills again. That's exactly what happened. The last budget surplus was 2002, lower than the one at the end of 2001, and from there, we have never seen daylight again. The budget deficits have just gotten worse and worse and worse. More and more T-bills flowing into the market, more and more of those T-bills available for open market operations. More and more control of the macroeconomy in the short run by the Federal Reserve. That was why there was the major discussion of a recession. In fact, the economic data indicates that we never had a recession in 2000, 2001, 2002. There was none. And there was no evidence that we really were in danger. The economy went to a zero growth rate for a little while, but it never went to recession. There's another dark side to this, too, pointing out that it's not all fun and games. It's another dark side. Remember that flow, the T-bill goes to the bank, goes to the Fed, and the trader sends the bank money in exchange for it. Remember that little trick right there? Okay. This is where it gets a little bit complicated. Follow. I'll go slowly. Okay. The bank has now acquired money, dollars, cash dollars in Tier 1 capital, and it has sent the Fed a T-bill, a government debt instrument. What that does is it, of course, caused the demand for T-bills by the DTT, by the traders buying up these T-bills. The demand for T-bills went from D1 to D2, driving the price of T-bills. The traders on the desk are bidding the prices up, in the case of our example there, from 975 to 990. The prices are pushing upward. So the price of T-bills is going up. The price of T-bills, through this operation, the price of T-bills goes up because of the demand surge, which means that the yield on the T-bills is going down. All is good in the world. Now let's take into play the government. The government borrows money at what are called treasury auctions. It offers a variety of instruments in most auctions, T-bills, T-notes, T-bonds, sometimes all of one, sometimes a mix of a couple, but almost always it needs short-term liquidity, so always T-bills are flowing. The Treasury has auctions on a regular basis. Let's talk about a Treasury auction in the context of open market operations. The Treasury has been sitting around, and then it says, okay, we need money to pay the light bills. We're going to run a T-bill auction. Demand for T-bills and the supply of T-bills, quantity and price. Now, I want you to tell me something here. Now, when the government suddenly wants to borrow money, it issues a bunch of T-bills, if it's short-term money it needs. Is that a demand change or a supply change if suddenly the Treasury puts a pile of T-bills on the table and says, here they are, please lend us money? That's a supply move. Supply of T-bills swishes outward. What does that do to the price of the T-bills? Drives them down, and the yields on the T-bills then go up. Well, prices go down. At every auction, the supply of T-bills suddenly surges, and sure enough, you'll see the price of T-bills in the open market go down. Now, let me go back up here. See that money? The bank got money from the open market operation with the domestic trader a few days before. What do you suppose that bank is going to do? Yeah? Not sell them to the bank. No. It'll work the other way. You're on exactly the right track, though, because you see the bank has just gotten dollars for the T-bills that the traders bought. So the bank is sitting on this money. It can decide, well, I could lend that money to businesses and to people, or I could hold that money for a few days until a Treasury auction, because as soon as the Treasury puts those Treasury bills on the table, the price of Treasuries will go down, and I can buy them knowing damn well that the Fed, if it's still adding liquidity, will buy them from me at a higher price when the traders start hitting the market with their liquidity expansion buys. Follow me again. The domestic traders bought T-bills from the bank, and that drove the price of T-bills up, and the banks got dollars for them. Now the banks have dollars. Now suddenly the Treasury comes in to borrow money. It increases the supply of T-bills, driving their prices down, making them a bargain. Well, the banks now have dollars. They'll go to those auctions, and they will buy those cheaper T-bills because they know that that damn trader is going to come back in a few days and say, I want to buy T-bills from you. And they'll be able to make that trader push the price up, and they'll buy the T-bills from you. You'll bid up. See, you gave me money the last time. I'm just going to go and wait for an auction, because as soon as the Treasury has that auction, the price of T-bills will sink because the supply is has surged. I'll just go over there and buy those, and then I'll sit there and wait for you to call me again. I want T-bills. I don't want to give up my T-bills. I'll pay you more. Oh, really? How much more? And then I'll cause you to bid the price up. I'll give them to you. Okay, T-bills. You give me a pile of money, then I'll just step back and wait for our Treasury auction. Because the government is borrowing so much money, I'll just wait for the Treasury auction. Supply will go up, price of the T-bills will go down, and I get them at a bargain, and I wait for you to call me like a desperate poodle looking for a leg to hump, and I will, I'll just get you again. I'll just keep doing this. This is what's been going on for about, 3 years now, 4 years almost, this cycle. That was why it was driving economists and government officials crazy. Why is all this money going into the banks and we're still not getting the banks to lend? Why would they lend to you when they got a guarantee that the federal government's going to borrow the money and they're going to put treasuries on the table that'll sink the price of the treasuries? You buy them at a bargain and wait for the traders at the Federal Reserve to come and bid the price up, and then I'll sell them to you, and I can make essentially a cash cow go on. That was why the economy struggled for so long, even though massive amounts of liquidity were being added. Essentially, understand what's happening. There are a couple of things. First of all, just massive amounts of money were just flowing into the economy through this process, but it wasn't causing any traction. That's why we sputtered in the recovery for so long. The second thing that's also kind of an interesting side part of this is that basically, what's happening is that the government needs to borrow money. Now, obviously, we've got some friends, China, Japan, Canada, and other countries lend us a lot of money for our federal debt. We run federal deficits. It's us. We borrow money. That's our thing. But you see, by this method, when the treasury auctions happen, the banks go and buy the treasuries. And then they wait for the domestic trading desk to call and buy those treasuries from them. So basically, it's like a triangle deal where the government borrows money, the banks participate by lending money, and then the Federal Reserve buys those treasuries from the banks, gives banks like me money, and then I go and buy more treasury bills, essentially lending the government money. Because as a bank, if I buy a treasury bill, I'm the lender to the government. But then the Federal Reserve comes in and buys that T-bill from me, so I'm no longer the lender to the government. The Federal Reserve is the lender to the government. You follow how it works? Because I as a bank will go to the auction. I lend the government money. But then you, a trader for the Federal Reserve, buy the T-bill from me, so you become the lender to the government. So basically, the federal government is working through the banks to borrow money from the Fed. But the Fed, what is the Fed? Is it an independent company? What did I tell you? What is the Federal Reserve? Is the Federal Reserve an independent corporation, or what is it? It is part of the U.S. government. It is technically an agency of the Treasury Department. So what is happening is that essentially the banks are a middleman for the government to borrow money from itself. That's a really good deal. You need to work out so that you can do that yourself someday. You can actually borrow money from yourself. That's what is essentially happening in open market operations these days. When the banks buy at the treasury auctions and then they sell them to the Fed, those treasuries, to get money into the economy, essentially the Federal Reserve is becoming the lender, the guarantor of the banks. And so the federal government, the treasury, is borrowing money from itself, which is very cool. work out how you can do that yourself, and you too could become a nation like the United States. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.